Protagoras, a dialogue of Socrates with companion.
Where have you come from, Socrates? Or is it obvious, from hunting after Alcibiades and his youthful bloom? And yet, when I saw him the other day, he still looked handsome, but a man now, Socrates, just between us, and his beard is already coming in thick.
And so what? Aren't you the one who praises Homer, who said the most charming time of youth is when the beard first appears, which is exactly the stage Alcibiades is at now?
Well, what about it now? Are you coming from him, and how does the young man feel about you these days?
Well, very well, I thought, and especially so today. In fact, he said a great deal on my behalf, coming to my defense, and it's from him that I've just come. But there's something odd I want to tell you. With him right there, I paid him no attention and kept forgetting he was even present.
What could possibly have happened between the two of you to cause that? Surely you haven't met anyone more beautiful, at least not in this city.
Much more beautiful.
What are you saying, a citizen or a foreigner?
A foreigner.
From where?
Abdera.
And this foreigner seemed so beautiful to you that he appeared more beautiful than the son of Clanias.
And why shouldn't the wisest appear more beautiful, my good man?
But Socrates, have you really been in the company of some wise man?
The wisest, I'd say, of anyone alive today, if you consider Protagoras the wisest.
What are you saying? Protagoras is in town.
This is already his third day here.
And you've just now come from being with him.
Yes, indeed. And I said a great deal and heard a great deal in return.
Then why not tell us about the conversation? If nothing prevents you, sit down here and send this boy off his stool.
Of course, and I'll be grateful if you listen.
And we'll be grateful to you if you tell it.
Then the gratitude will be double. But listen. Last night, still deep in the dark before dawn, Hippocrates, son of Apollodorus and brother of Phason, came pounding on my door with his walking stick, very hard. And when someone opened it for him, he rushed straight in, urgent, and said in a loud voice, "Socrates, are you awake or asleep?" And I, recognizing his voice, said, "Hippocrates, is that you? You're not bringing bad news, are you?" "Nothing but good," he said. "Good to hear," I said. "But what is it, and why have you come at this hour?" "Protagoras has arrived," he said, standing right beside me. "He came the day before yesterday," I said. "Are you only just now finding out?" "By the gods," he said, "only this evening." And at the same time he felt around for the couch and sat down by my feet and said, "Yes, this evening, very late in fact, on my way back from Ono. My slave Satyrus ran off from me, you see, and I was going to tell you I meant to go after him, but something else made me forget about it. Then when I got home, and we'd had dinner and were about to go to bed, my brother told me Protagoras had arrived. I thought about coming straight to you right then, but then it seemed to me too far into the night. But as soon as sleep let go of me after all that exhaustion, I got up at once and came straight here." And I, recognizing his courage and his agitation, said, "What's this to you, then? Is Protagoras doing you some wrong?" And he laughed and said, "Yes, by the gods, Socrates, that he alone is wise and doesn't make me so. But by Zeus," I said, "if you give him money and win him over, he'll make you wise too." "If only," he said, "O Zeus and the gods, if only that were all it took. I wouldn't spare a thing of my own or my friends. But that's exactly why I've come to you now, so you can speak to him on my behalf. I'm younger than you, for one thing, and besides, I've never once seen Protagoras or heard him speak. I was still a child the last time he visited." "Well, Socrates, everyone praises the man and says he's the most skilled speaker there is. But why aren't we walking over to him, so we can catch him at home? He's staying, I hear, with Callias, son of Hipponicus. Let's go. And I said, Not yet, my friend, let's not go there yet, it's early, but let's get up and go out into the courtyard here, and pass the time walking around until it gets light. Then we'll go. Protagoras spends most of his time indoors anyway, so don't worry, we're sure to catch him in. After that we got up and walked around in the courtyard, and I, testing Hippocrates' resolve, examined him and asked, Tell me, Hippocrates, now that you're setting out to go to Protagoras and pay him money as a fee on your own behalf, who exactly is it you're going to, and what are you going to become? It's as if you were planning to go to your namesake, Hippocrates of Cos, of the family of Asclepius, and pay him a fee on your behalf, and someone asked you, Tell me, Hippocrates, you're about to pay Hippocrates a fee as being what sort of man? What would you answer? I'd say, he said, as a doctor. And what would you yourself become? A doctor, he said. And if you were planning to go to Polyclitus of Argos or Phidias of Athens and pay them a fee on your own behalf, and someone asked you, You intend to pay this money to Polyclitus and Phidias as being what sort of men? What would you answer? I'd say, as sculptors. And what would you yourself become? Clearly a sculptor. Very well, I said. Now, when you and I go to Protagoras, ready to pay him money as a fee on your behalf, if our own money is enough to persuade him, and if not, spending our friend's money too, if someone asked us, so intent on this business, tell me, Socrates and Hippocrates, as being what sort of man do you intend to pay Protagoras money? What would we answer him? What name do we hear applied to Protagoras? The way we hear sculptor, applied to Phidias and poet to Homer. What such name do we hear for Protagoras? They call the man a sophist, Socrates, he said. So it's as a sophist that we're going to pay him the money. Certainly. And if someone were to ask you this too, as what do you yourself intend to become by going to Protagoras? And he answered, blushing, for it was already growing light enough to see him clearly, if it's anything like the previous cases, clearly a sophist. And you, I said, by the gods, wouldn't you be ashamed to present yourself to the Greeks as a sophist? By Zeus, Socrates, I would, if I have to say what I really think. But then, Hippocrates, is it perhaps not that kind of instruction you expect to get from Protagoras, but rather the kind you got from your writing teacher, your music teacher, and your gymnastics trainer? For you didn't learn any of those as a craft, meaning to become a professional at it, but for education, as befits a private citizen and a free man. Yes, he said, that seems to me much more like what instruction from Protagoras would be. Do you know, then, what you're about to do, or does it escape you? I said, About what? That you're about to hand over your soul to be cared for by a man who is, as you say, a sophist. But as for what a sophist actually is, I'd be surprised if you know. And yet, if you're ignorant of that, you don't even know to whom you're entrusting your soul, or whether it's to something good or something bad. I think I do know, he said. Tell me, then, what do you take a sophist to be? I think, he said, as the name itself says, one who has knowledge of wise things. Well, I said, one could say the same of painters and carpenters, that they're knowledgeable in wise things. But if someone asked us, wise in what are painters knowledgeable? We'd say in producing likenesses, and so on for the rest. But if someone asked that other question, the sophist is wise in what? What would we answer him? What sort of work is he in charge of? What would we say he is, Socrates, except one in charge of making a person skilled at speaking? Perhaps, I said, that would be true, but not adequate enough, for our answer still calls for a further question about what does the sophist make one skilled at speaking? A lyre player, for instance, makes one skilled at speaking about the very thing he himself has knowledge of, namely lyre-playing, doesn't he?
Yes.
Very well. And about what does the sophist make one skilled at speaking? Clearly about whatever he himself has knowledge of.
Likely enough.
So what is this thing, about which the sophist himself is knowledgeable and makes his student so as well?
By Zeus, he said, I can no longer tell you.
And I said after this, well then, do you realize into what sort of danger you're about to put your soul? If you had to entrust your body to someone, at risk of it becoming either good or ruined, you'd think hard about whether to entrust it or not, and you'd call in your friends and family for advice, deliberating for days on end. But when it comes to something you value more than your body, your soul, on whose being good or bad your whole life's faring well or badly depends, about this, you've consulted neither your father nor your brother nor any one of us your companions as to whether you should entrust your soul to this foreigner who's just arrived. Instead, having heard about him yesterday evening, as you say, you come here at dawn, and about this matter you make no argument and take no counsel at all as to whether you ought to entrust yourself to him or not. You're ready to spend your own money and your friend's money, as though you'd already decided you absolutely must study with Protagoras, whom, as you say, you neither know nor have ever conversed with, yet you call a sophist, while you appear ignorant of what a sophist even is. This man to whom you're about to entrust yourself. And when he heard this, he said, it does seem so, Socrates, from what you say. Well then, Hippocrates, is the sophist perhaps a kind of merchant or trader in the goods by which the soul is nourished? For that's how he strikes me, at any rate. But Socrates, what is the soul nourished by?
By lessons, surely, I said.
And take care, my friend, that the sophist, in praising what he sells, doesn't deceive us, the way those dealing in the body's nourishment do, the merchant and the trader. For these people, too, don't themselves know which of the goods they carry is good or bad for the body, but praise everything they sell all the same, and neither do those who buy from them know, unless one happens to be a trainer or a doctor. In the same way, those who carry their lessons around from city to city, selling and peddling them to whoever desires them at the time, praise everything they sell. But it may be, my excellent friend, that some of them too are ignorant of whether what they're selling is good or bad for the soul, and likewise those who buy from them, unless one happens, in turn, to be a doctor of the soul. So if you yourself happen to have knowledge of what is good and bad in these matters, it's safe for you to buy lessons from Protagoras or from anyone else at all. But if not, take care, my dear fellow, that you're not gambling with what is dearest to you, and taking the greatest of risks. And in fact, there is far greater danger in buying up teachings than in buying food. When you buy food and drink from the grocer or merchant, you can carry it away in separate containers, and before you take it into your body by eating or drinking it, you can set it down at home and call in someone knowledgeable to advise you what to eat or drink and what not to, and how much and when. So there isn't much risk in that purchase. But teachings can't be carried off in a separate container. You have no choice but to hand over the price, take the teaching directly into your soul by learning it, and go your way either harmed or helped. So this is something we should look into, and with the help of our elders too, since we're still young enough that a matter this large is beyond us to sort out on our own. Still, for now, since we already set out to do it, let's go and hear the man, and once we've heard him, let's share it with others too. Protagoras isn't the only one there. There's also Hippias of Elis, and I believe Prodicus of Ceos, and many other clever men besides. Having decided this, we went on our way. When we reached the front door, we stopped to finish a discussion we'd fallen into on the road, so as not to leave it hanging. We stood there in the doorway talking until we'd reached agreement.
Now it seems that the doorkeeper, some eunuch, was listening in on us. And I suppose, given how many sophists come through, he's grown tired of the people who show up at the house. In any case, when we knocked, he opened up, saw us, and said, sophists, and added that the master had no time for visitors. And with that he slammed the door shut with both hands as forcefully as he could manage. We knocked again, and with the door still bolted, he answered, "Didn't you people hear me?" "He has no time." "But my good man," I said, "we haven't come to see Callias, and we aren't sophists." "Don't worry, we came wanting to see Protagoras." "So go announce us." Only then, reluctantly, did the fellow finally open the door for us. Once we'd gone in, we found Protagoras walking about in the covered porch, and walking alongside him in a row on one side were Callias, son of Hipponicus, and his half-brother on his mother's side, Perillus, son of Pericles, and Charmide, son of Glaucon, and on the other side, Pericles' other son, Xanthippus, and Philippide, son of Philomelus, and Antimaurus of Mende, the most highly regarded of Protagoras' students, who is studying to become a professional sophist himself. Following behind, listening to what was said, were mostly foreigners, whom Protagoras draws along from each of the cities he passes through, charming them with his voice like Orpheus, and they follow, spellbound by that voice, though there were also a few locals mixed into the chorus. I especially enjoyed watching that chorus, how carefully they took care never to get in Protagoras's way. Whenever he turned around, along with those with him, these listeners would neatly and orderly split apart to either side, circle around, and reassemble behind him in perfect formation every time. And next I noticed, as Homer would say, Hippias of Eli's, seated on a chair in the porch across the way. Around him, on benches, sat Eryximachus, son of Acumenus, Phaedrus of Myrhinus, Andron, son of Androtion, and some of the foreigners, fellow citizens of his and others. They seemed to be questioning Hippias about nature and the heavens, matters of astronomy, and he, seated on his chair, was sorting out each question and going through the answers point by point. And indeed, I also caught sight of Tantalus, for Prodicus of Ceos happened to be visiting too. He was in a certain room which Hipponicus used to use as a storeroom, but which Callias has now emptied out and turned into guest lodging, given how many visitors are staying there. Prodicus was still lying in bed, wrapped up in some fleeces and a great many blankets by the look of it. Sitting near him on the neighboring couches were Pausanias of Cerames, and with Pausanias, a young fellow still quite a boy, fine in nature, I'd guess, and certainly very handsome in appearance. I thought I heard his name was Agathon, and I wouldn't be surprised if he turns out to be Pausanias's beloved. That boy was there, and both of the Adaemantuses, the one son of Sepes and the one son of Leucolophides, and some others as well. As for what they were discussing, I couldn't make it out from outside, much as I long to hear Prodicus. The man strikes me as immensely wise, practically divine, but the deep resonance of his voice set up a kind of booming in the room that blurred the words. We had only just come in when, right behind us, in walked Alcibiades, the handsome one, as you call him, and I'm inclined to agree, and Crisius, son of Callistratus. So once we were inside, we lingered a bit taking all this in, and then went up to Protagoras, and I said, "Protagoras, it's you we've come for, myself and Hippocrates here." "Do you want," he said, "to talk with me alone or with the others present too?" "It makes no difference to us," I said. "Once you've heard why we've come, you can judge for yourself." "Well, what is it then," he said, "that brings you here?" "This is Hippocrates, a local, son of Apollodorus of a great and prosperous house. In his own nature he seems a match for anyone his age. He wants, I think, to become someone of note in the city, and he believes the surest way to that is by spending time with you. So now it's for you to decide whether you think it best to discuss this alone, just the two of us, or with the others too. You do well, Socrates, he said, to look out for me this way. For a foreigner who goes into great cities and there persuades the best of the young men to leave the company of others, kin and strangers, older and younger alike, and join him instead, on the promise that they'll be better for his company, needs to be careful in doing so. Such things stir up no small envy, ill will, and scheming. Now I myself say that the sophist's art is an ancient one, but that the men of old who practiced it, fearing the resentment it provokes, used other things as a screen and a disguise. Some used poetry, like Homer, Hesiod, and Simonides. Others used rites and prophecies, the circle around Orpheus and Musaeus. And I've noticed some who used athletic training, like Icus of Tarentum, and still active today, a sophist second to none, Hierodicus of Celimbria, originally of Megara. Others used music as their screen, like your own Agathocles, who was truly a great sophist, and Pythocles of Ceos, and many others. All of these men, as I say, out of fear of that envy, used these arts as their veils. But I don't agree with any of them on this point. I think they accomplished nothing of what they intended. They didn't manage to fool the people in each city who actually hold power, the very ones these disguises are meant for. The ordinary crowd notices nothing to speak of, and simply repeats whatever these leading men pass along. So for someone trying to run away to fail at running away, and instead to stand out in plain sight, is sheer folly, and it's bound to make people far more hostile, since they come to think such a man is, on top of everything else, a schemer. As for me, I've taken the entirely opposite path. I openly admit to being a sophist and to educating people, and I think this kind of caution is better than the other, admitting it outright rather than denying it. I've taken other precautions too, so that, God willing, I suffer no harm from admitting I'm a sophist. And indeed, I've been many years now in this profession. My years altogether add up to a great many. There's not one of you I couldn't be old enough to have fathered. So nothing would please me more, if you're willing, than to discuss all this in front of everyone here inside. And I suspecting he wanted to show off in front of Prodicus and Hippias and Prenobit, since we'd come, as his admirers said, well then, why don't we call Prodicus and Hippias and those with them in, so they can listen to us? By all means, said Protagoras. Shall we, said Callias, set up a proper sitting so you can all talk seated? We agreed we should, and all of us, delighted at the prospect of hearing wise men speak, took hold of the benches and couches ourselves and arranged them by Hippias, since the benches were already there. Meanwhile Callias and Alcibiades arrived bringing Prodicus, having gotten him up from his couch, along with those who were with him. Once we were all seated together, Protagoras said, Now then, Socrates, you may speak, since these men are present too, about the matter you mentioned to me a little while ago concerning the young man. And I said that my starting point was the same as before, Protagoras, the very thing I'd come about. Hippocrates here happens to be eager for your company, and he says he'd be glad to learn what will come of it for him if he spends time with you. That's the whole of what we have to say. Protagoras answered, taking this up. Young man, if you keep company with me, here is what will happen. On the very day you join me, you'll go home a better man, and the same the next day, and every single day you'll keep improving further still. Hearing this, I said, Protagoras, there's nothing surprising in what you say, it's only natural, since even you, wise and accomplished as you already are, would become better if someone taught you something you didn't happen to know. But don't put it that way. Suppose instead that Hippocrates here suddenly changed his mind and wanted to study with that young man who has just arrived in town, Zeuxippus of Heraclea, and went to him, as he's now come to you, and heard the very same thing from him that he heard from you, that each day spent in his company would make him better and he'd keep improving, and then asked him, Better at what, and improving toward what? Zeuxippus would tell him, painting. Or suppose he'd studied with Orthagoras the Theban and heard the same words from him, and asked what he'd be improving toward day by day in his company, he'd say, flute playing. So you too, tell the young man and me, since I'm asking on his behalf, if Hippocrates here keeps company with Protagoras, on whatever day he does so he'll go away improved, and likewise each following day he'll keep improving, but toward what Protagoras and in regard to what? And Protagoras, hearing this from me, said, you ask well, Socrates, and I'm glad to answer those who ask well. Hippocrates, in coming to me, will not suffer what he would have suffered from studying with any other sophist. The others mistreat the young. Fleeing as they do from technical subjects, these men drag them back against their will into more technical subjects, arithmetic, astronomy, geometry, and music. Here he glanced toward Hippias, whereas anyone who comes to me will learn about nothing but the very thing he came for. And that subject is sound judgment in one's own affairs, how best to manage one's own household, and in the city's affairs, how to be most capable both in acting and in speaking on the city's behalf. Am I following your argument? I said. You seem to be describing the political art and promising to make men into good citizens. That's exactly it, he said. Socrates, that's the profession I profess. Well, I said, that's a fine skill you've acquired if you've really acquired it. I'll say nothing to you but what I think. I myself, Protagoras, didn't believe this thing could be taught, but when you say it can, I don't see how to disbelieve you. I ought to explain why I think it isn't teachable, or something no human being can arrange for another. I say the Athenians, like the rest of the Greeks, are wise people. Now I notice that when we're gathered in the assembly, if the city has some business to do about building, we send for builders to advise about buildings, and if it's about shipbuilding, we send for shipwrights, and so on for everything else that's considered learnable and teachable. And if anyone else tries to advise them who isn't thought to be a craftsman in that field, however handsome, wealthy, or well-born he may be, they pay him no more attention for it. Instead, they laugh him down and shout him out, until either the speaker gives up and steps back, shouted into silence, or the archers drag him off or have him removed at the presiding officer's order. That's how they behave about matters they consider technical. But when it comes to deliberating about running the city, anyone stands up to advise them a carpenter just as much as a smith or a cobbler, a merchant or a ship's captain, rich or poor, well-born or not, and no one attacks him the way they attack the others, for not having learned anywhere, having had no teacher, and yet daring to give advice. Clearly, they don't think this can be taught. And it isn't just true of the city as a whole, privately too. The wisest and best of our citizens are unable to pass on to others the virtue they themselves possess. Take Pericles, the father of these young men here. He gave them a fine education in everything that depended on teachers, but in the area where he himself is wise, he neither teaches them himself nor hands them over to anyone else. They just wander around grazing like sacred cattle set loose, in case they happen to stumble onto virtue on their own. Or take Clinias, the younger brother of this Alcibiades here, this same Pericles, as his guardian, afraid he'd be corrupted by Alcibiades, took him away and placed him in Arifron's household to be educated. But before 6 months were up, he gave him back, at a loss for what to do with him. I could give you countless other examples of men who are good themselves, but have never made anyone else better, neither their own kin nor anyone else's. So Protagoras, looking at these facts, I don't believe virtue can be taught. But then I hear you saying it can, and I waver. I think you must be onto something, because I take you to have had wide experience, learned a great deal, and worked out some things for yourself. So if you can show us more clearly that virtue is teachable, please don't hold back, show us. Well, Socrates, he said, I won't hold back. But should I show you this by telling a story, as an older man to younger ones, or by working it out step by step in argument. Many of those sitting nearby told him to proceed however he preferred. "In that case," he said, "I think it will be more pleasant to tell you a story. There was once a time when there were gods, but no mortal creatures yet existed. When the destined time came for these two to be born, the gods shaped them inside the earth, mixing earth and fire together with whatever combines with fire and earth. When it was time to bring them out into the light, the gods assigned Prometheus and Epimetheus to equip them and distribute abilities to each kind as was fitting. Epimetheus begged Prometheus to let him do the distributing himself, and once I've distributed them," he said, "you can inspect the results," and having persuaded him, he set to work. In his distribution, he gave some creatures strength without speed, while equipping the weaker ones with speed. Some he armed, and to others, giving them no weapons, he devised some other capacity for their preservation. To those he clothed in smallness, he gave winged flight or an underground dwelling. Those he built up in size he preserved by that very size, and so on, evening things out as he distributed. He arranged all this with an eye to preventing any species from being wiped out entirely. And once he had provided them means of escaping mutual destruction, he devised protection against the seasons that come from Zeus, clothing them in thick fur and tough hides, sufficient to ward off winter and capable of resisting heat as well, and so that when they went to rest each creature would have its own natural bedding built in. And he shod some with hooves, others with tough, bloodless hide and fur. After that he arranged different foods for different creatures, for some, grass from the ground, for others the fruits of trees, for others roots, and to some he gave the flesh of other animals as food. To these he gave low fertility, while to the ones being eaten by them he gave high fertility, securing the survival of the species. But since Epimetheus wasn't especially wise, he didn't notice that he had used up all the capacities on the irrational animals. The human race was left completely unequipped, and he was at a loss what to do. While he was still stuck, Prometheus came to inspect the distribution, and saw that while the other animals were suitably furnished in every way, man was naked, unshod, without bedding, and unarmed, and already the appointed day was at hand when man too was to come forth from the earth into the light. So Prometheus, at a loss for any means of saving man, stole the skilled wisdom of Hephaestus and Athena, together with fire, since without fire it was impossible for anyone to acquire or use that wisdom, and so he gave it as a gift to man. In this way man came to possess the wisdom needed for life, but he did not have the political kind, for that was in the keeping of Zeus. Prometheus no longer had the chance to enter the citadel where Zeus dwelt, and besides, the guards of Zeus were terrifying, but he slipped unnoticed into the workshop shared by Athena and Hephaestus, where they practiced their crafts together, and stealing Hephaestus's art of fire along with Athena's art as well, he gave them to man. From this came man's resourcefulness in life, but Prometheus, because of Epimetheus, was later, so the story goes, brought to justice for the theft. Once man had a share of the divine portion, first, because of his kinship with God, he alone among the animals believed in gods and set about establishing altars and images of them. Then he quickly worked out, through his skill, articulate speech and names, and he invented houses, clothing, sandals, bedding, and food from the earth. Equipped in this way, humans at first lived scattered about. There were no cities. So they were destroyed by wild animals, since they were weaker than the beasts in every way, and their skill in crafts, while adequate help for feeding themselves, was insufficient for the war against the animals, for they did not yet have the political art, of which the art of war is a part. So they sought to gather together and save themselves by founding cities. But whenever they gathered together, they wronged one another, since they had no political art, and so they scattered again and kept being destroyed. Zeus then, fearing that our whole race would be wiped out, sent Hermes to bring men a sense of shame and a sense of justice, so that there might be order in cities and bonds of friendship to bring people together. Hermes then asked Zeus in what way he should give justice and shame to men. Should I distribute them the way the arts have been distributed? They have been distributed like this. One person with medical knowledge is enough for many laymen, and so with the other craftsmen. Should I place justice and shame among men in this same way, or distribute them to everyone? To everyone, said Zeus, and let all have a share. For cities could never come to be if only a few shared in them, as with the other arts. And make this a law from me. Whoever cannot share in shame and justice is to be put to death as a sickness upon the city. That, Socrates, is the reason why the Athenians and everyone else, when the discussion concerns skill in carpentry or any other craft, think that only a few should have a say, and if someone outside that few tries to advise them, they won't stand for it, as you say, and reasonably so, I would add. But when they turn to deliberating about political virtue, which must proceed entirely through justice and moderation, they reasonably tolerate advice from every man, since it's fitting that everyone share in this virtue, or else there would be no cities at all. That, Socrates, is the reason for this. And to keep you from thinking you're being deceived, that people really do believe every man shares in justice and the rest of political virtue, take this further proof. In the other virtues, as you say, if someone claims to be a good flute player, or claims any other skill he doesn't have, people either laugh at him or grow angry, and his own family comes and scolds him as if he were out of his mind. But when it comes to justice and the rest of political virtue, even if they know a man is unjust, if he himself admits the truth about himself in front of everyone, what would count as sanity in the other case, telling the truth, here they count as madness? They say everyone must claim to be just, whether he is or not, and that anyone who doesn't pretend to justice is out of his mind, on the grounds that it's necessary for every single person to share in it somehow, or else not be counted among human beings at all. So much for why they reasonably accept every man as an advisor about this virtue, since they believe everyone has a share in it. I'll try to show you next that they don't consider it something that comes by nature or by chance, but something taught, and that it comes about, wherever it does, through deliberate effort. Whatever evils people believe others have by nature or by chance, no one gets angry at them for it, or scolds them, or teaches them, or punishes them, hoping to change them, people simply pity them. Take the ugly, the short, or the weak, who is foolish enough to try to do anything about those. People know, I think, that such things come to human beings by nature and chance, both the good ones and their opposites. But whatever good things people believe come about through care, practice, and teaching, if someone lacks these and instead has the opposite, bad qualities, it's for these that anger arises and punishment and reproof. Among these failings are injustice and impiety, and in short everything opposed to political virtue. In this domain, everyone gets angry at everyone else and reproves them, clearly on the assumption that virtue is something to be acquired through care and learning. If you're willing to think through what punishing wrongdoers actually accomplishes, Socrates, that alone will show you that people believe virtue can be instilled. No one punishes wrongdoers focusing simply on the fact that they did wrong, not unless he's acting like a mindless beast taking blind revenge. Someone who sets about punishing with reason in view doesn't take revenge for the sake of the past wrong, since he couldn't make what's done undone, but for the sake of the future, so that neither this person himself nor anyone else who sees him punished will do wrong again. Someone who thinks this way believes virtue can be taught at any rate. He punishes for the sake of deterrence. This is the view held by everyone who exacts punishment, whether privately or publicly. and other people punish and take vengeance on those they believe have wronged them, the Athenians, your own fellow citizens, not least of all. So by this reasoning, the Athenians too are among those who believe virtue can be instilled and taught. So I've shown you well enough, Socrates, it seems to me, both that your fellow citizens are right to accept advice on political matters from a smith or a cobbler, and that they believe virtue is teachable and can be instilled. There remains still the difficulty you raised about good men, why it is that good men teach their sons everything that depends on teachers, and make them wise in that, but do not make them any better than anyone else in the very virtue they themselves possess. About this, Socrates, I'll no longer tell you a story, but reason it through. Consider this. Is there some one thing, or is there not, that all citizens must necessarily share in, if there is to be a city at all? It's here, and nowhere else, that the difficulty you raise will be resolved. If it exists, and if that single thing is not carpentry, or bronze working, or pottery, but justice and self-control and holiness, if in short, I call it a single thing and name it a man's virtue if this is the thing that all must share in, and every man must act with this as his guide in whatever else he wishes to learn or do, and act in nothing without it. And if the man who does not share in it must be taught and punished, whether child or man or woman, until punishment makes him better. And if the one who will not listen to punishment and teaching must be cast out of the city or put to death as incurable if this is how things stand. And if, given that this is its nature, good men teach their sons everything else but not this, then consider how remarkably good men turn out to be. That they consider it teachable, both privately and publicly, we have shown. Given that it is teachable and can be cultivated, do they really teach their sons all the other things, for which there is no death penalty if a boy fails to learn them, but this one thing, for which the penalty is death for the boy himself and exile if he isn't taught and cultivated toward virtue, and beyond death the confiscation of property, and in a word, the overthrow of whole households this, do they not teach, and not take every care over it? You must believe they do, Socrates. Starting from when the children are very small, for as long as they live, they teach them and admonish them. As soon as a child understands what is said to him, the nurse, the mother, the tutor, and the father himself all struggle over this very point, that the boy should become as good as possible, teaching him and showing him, in connection with every deed and every word, that this is just and that is unjust, this is admirable and that is shameful. This is holy and that is unholy, do this and don't do that. And if he obeys willingly, well. If not, they straighten him like a warped and bent piece of wood, with threats and blows. After that, they send him to schoolmasters, and give far more instructions about his good behavior than about his letters and his music. The teachers take care of these things. And when the boys have learned their letters and are ready to understand what is written as they once understood the spoken word, the teachers set before them on their benches the poems of good poets to read, and make them learn them by heart poems full of much admonition, and many accounts and praises and eulogies of good men of old, so that the boy, admiring them, will imitate them and long to become such a man himself. The music teachers, for their part, do similar things. They take care of self-control and see that the young do nothing wrong. And further, once the boys have learned to play the lyre, they teach them the poems of yet other good poets, the composers of songs, setting them to the music of the lyre, and they make the rhythms and harmonies become part of the children's souls, so that they become gentler and more graceful in rhythm and harmony. And thus fit for speech and action, for the whole of human life stands in need of good rhythm and harmony. Beyond this, they also send the boy to a physical trainer, so that having a better body he may serve a mind that is good, and not be forced into cowardice through bodily weakness, whether in war or in other affairs. And this is done above all by those most able to do it. And those most able are the wealthiest and their sons, beginning to attend school earliest in age, leave off latest. And when they are done with their schoolmasters, the city in turn compels them to learn the laws and to live according to them as a pattern, so that they will not act on their own at random, but exactly as writing teachers, for children not yet skilled at writing, first trace letters lightly with the stylus, and then give them the tablet and make them write following the guidelines so to the city, having sketched out the laws, discoveries of good lawgivers of old. Compels people to rule and be ruled according to them, and whoever steps outside them, the city punishes. And this punishment, among you and in many other places, is called correction, since the penalty corrects. Given then how great a care is taken over virtue, both privately and publicly, do you still wonder, Socrates, and puzzle over whether virtue is teachable? You should not wonder at that. You should wonder far more if it were not teachable. Why then do many sons of good fathers turn out worthless? Learn this too. It is nothing to wonder at, if what I was saying earlier is true, that in this matter virtue, if there is to be a city at all, no one may be a private amateur in it. For if what I say is so, and it is so more than anything consider some other pursuit or study, choosing whichever you like as a comparison. Suppose it were impossible for there to be a city unless we were all flute players, each as good as he could manage, and everyone taught everyone else this skill both privately and publicly, and rebuked the one who played badly, and did not begrudge this teaching, just as now no one begrudges or hides his knowledge of justice and lawfulness, as people do with other skills, for I think each other's justice and virtue benefits us. Which is why everyone eagerly tells and teaches everyone else about just and lawful things well. If we had that same eagerness and generosity toward teaching one another flute playing, do you think, Socrates, he said, that the sons of good flute players would turn out any more to be good flute players than the sons of bad ones? I think not. Rather, whichever boy happened to be born with the greatest natural gift for flute playing would become renowned, and whichever was ungifted would remain obscure. And often a good flute player's son would turn out worthless, and often a bad one's son would turn out good. But in any case, all of them would be competent flute players, compared with ordinary people who have no knowledge of flute playing at all. In the same way you should think now, that whoever among you seems the most unjust of those raised among laws and among men would be just, and a master craftsman of justice, if he had to be judged next to men who have neither education nor courts nor laws nor any compulsion at all constantly forcing them to care for virtue men who were savage, like those Pharocrates the poet put on stage last year at the Lenya. Truly, if you found yourself among people like that, like the man-haters in that chorus, you would be glad to run into an Eurybatus or a Phrynandas, and you would wail with longing for the wickedness of the people here. As it is, you are spoiled, Socrates, because everyone is a teacher of virtue, each to the extent he is able, and so none of them seems to you to be one at all. It's as if you were looking for who teaches Greek, no one at all would turn up. And I don't think either, if you looked for who could teach the sons of craftsmen this very craft which they have in fact learned from their fathers to whatever extent the father was skilled, and the father's friends who shared the same craft who could teach them further, it would not be easy, Socrates, I think, to point to a teacher for these boys, though for the utterly untrained it is perfectly easy. And so it is with virtue and with everything else. But even if there is someone who has even a slight edge over us in advancing people toward virtue, that is something to be grateful for. And I believe I am one of those, and that I can benefit a person, more than other men can, toward becoming admirable and good, and that I am worth the fee I charge, and even more, so much so that the student himself agrees. That is why I have arranged the manner of collecting my fee as follows. Whenever someone has learned from me, if he wishes, he pays the sum I charge. But if not, he goes to a temple, swears an oath as to how much he judges the lessons to be worth, and deposits that amount. That, Socrates, he said, is the story and the argument I have offered you, to show that virtue is teachable, and that the Athenians hold this view, and that it is no wonder that worthless sons come from good fathers and good sons from worthless ones, since even the sons of Polycletus, contemporaries of Paralus and this Xanthippus here, are nothing next to their father, and the same is true of other craftsmen's sons. But it is not yet fair to accuse these two of that. There is still hope in them, for they are young. With this and much more besides, Protagoras finished his display and stopped speaking. And I, for a long while, still spellbound, kept looking at him as though he were going to say more, eager to hear it. But when I realized that he had truly finished, I gathered myself together, somehow, with an effort, and looking at Hippocrates, said, "Son of Apollodorus, how grateful I am to you for urging me to come here. I count it a great thing to have heard what I have heard from Protagoras. Before now, I used to think there was no human effort by which good men become good, but now I am persuaded there is. Except for one small thing standing in my way, which Protagoras will surely clear up easily, since he has already cleared up so much. For if someone were to talk with any public speaker about these very matters, he might well hear speeches just as fine from Pericles or some other capable speaker. But if you ask any of them a further question, they can no more answer than a book can, nor ask a question themselves. And if you question even slightly on some small point of what they said, they are like bronze vessels, which when struck ring on and drag out the sound unless someone stops them, and the orators are just the same. Ask something small, they draw out a whole marathon of speech. But Protagoras here is capable both of making long, fine speeches, as his own words show, and also, when asked, of answering briefly, and when he asks a question, of waiting for and accepting the answer, something few are equipped to do. So now, Protagoras, I need only one small thing to have everything, if you would answer me this. You say virtue is teachable, and I, if I would trust any man on earth, trust you. But there is something you said that puzzled me, and I would like you to fill in that gap for me. You said that Zeus sent justice and reverence to mankind, and again, in many places in your speech, you spoke of justice, self-control, and holiness, and all these together, as though they were one single thing, virtue. Go through this for me carefully and precisely. Is virtue one thing, of which justice, self-control, and holiness are parts, or are these all names for one and the same thing? That is what I still long to know. Well, that is easy to answer, Socrates, he said. Virtue is one thing, and these are parts of it, which you ask about. Are they parts, I said, in the way that the parts of a face are parts mouth, nose, eyes, and ears, or are they like the parts of a lump of gold, which do not differ from one another, or from the whole, except in being larger or smaller? It seems to me, Socrates, the former way, as the parts of a face relate to the whole face. Then do people, I asked, partake of these parts of virtue differently, one man having one and another having another, or must a man, once he has one, have all of them? Not at all, he said, since many are brave but unjust, and again many are just but not wise. So these two are parts of virtue, I said, wisdom and courage. Most certainly, he said, and wisdom is the greatest of the parts. And each of them is distinct, I said, one thing and another. Yes. And does each of them have its own particular power? Just as with the parts of a face, the eye is not like the ears, nor is its power the same, and none of the other parts is like any other, either in power or in anything else. Isn't it the same, then, with the parts of virtue, that one is not like another, neither itself nor its power? Isn't that clearly how it is, if it resembles the example? Yes, that's how it is, Socrates, he said. And I said, then none of the parts of virtue is like knowledge, or like justice, or like courage, or like moderation, or like piety.
No, he said. Come then, I said, let's examine together what sort of thing each of them is.
First, this, is justice a real thing or not a thing at all?
To me it seems real. What about you?
To me too, he said.
Well then, if someone asked you and me, Protagoras and Socrates, tell me, this thing you just named justice, is it itself just or unjust?
I would answer that it is just.
What verdict would you give, the same as mine, or a different one?
The same, he said.
So justice is such as to be just. That's how I'd answer if someone asked, and you too.
Yes, he said.
And if after that he asked us, don't you also say there's such a thing as piety?
We'd say yes, I imagine.
Yes, he said.
And you say this too as a thing?
We'd say so or not.
He agreed to this as well.
And do you say this thing itself is such as to be unholy, or such as to be holy?
For my part, I said, I'd be indignant at the question and say,
watch your words, friend. It would hardly be easy for anything else to be holy, if piety itself isn't holy.
And you, wouldn't you answer the same way?
Certainly, he said.
Then if after that he asked us, so, what were you saying a little earlier?
Did I hear you right?
You seem to me to say that the parts of virtue stand to one another, in such a way that one is not like another.
I would say that you heard the rest correctly, but if you think I said that, you misheard. It was Protagoras here who gave that answer. I was only asking.
So if he asked, is what this man says true, Protagoras?
Do you claim that one part of virtue is not like another?
Is that your position?
What would you answer him?
I'd have no choice, he said, Socrates, but to admit it.
Well then, Protagoras, having admitted that, what shall we answer him if he presses further?
Then piety is not such as to be a just thing, nor justice such as to be holy, but such as to be not holy. And piety is such as to be not just, but unjust, and the other unholy.
What shall we answer him?
For my own part, I would say that justice is holy and piety is just, and on your behalf too, if you'd let me, I would give the same answer, that justice and piety are either the same thing, or as alike as anything could be, and that justice is above all like piety, and piety like justice.
But see whether you object to my answering that way, or whether you agree.
It doesn't seem to me, Socrates, he said, quite so simple that I should concede that justice is holy and piety is just. Rather, there seems to me to be some difference in it.
But still, what difference does that make?
He said, if you like, let's grant that justice is holy and piety is just.
Not for my sake, I said, I have no need of that if you like, or if it seems so to you being tested, but of you and me. I mean that phrase, you and me, because I think the argument would be tested best if one took the if out of it.
Well, but justice certainly does resemble piety in some way. He said, anything resembles anything else in some respect.
White resembles black in a way, and hard resembles soft, and all the other things that seem most opposite to one another. And the things we said earlier had different powers and were not alike. The parts of the face resemble one another in some way, and one is like the other.
So by that method, you could prove even these things are all alike to one another, if you wanted.
But it isn't right to call things alike just because they share something in common, nor unlike because they share something different, even if what they share is very small.
And I said to him in astonishment, is that really how justice and piety stand to each other in your view, that they share only some small point of resemblance?
Not quite that, he said, but not what you seem to think either.
Well then, I said, since you seem uneasy about this, let's set it aside and look at something else you said.
Do you call something folly?
He agreed. Isn't wisdom the complete opposite of this thing?
It seems so to me, he said.
And when people act rightly and beneficially, do you think they're being moderate when they act that way, or if they acted the opposite?
Moderate, he said.
So they're moderate by moderation.
Necessarily.
And those who don't act rightly act foolishly, and are not being moderate when they act that way.
I agree, he said.
So acting foolishly is the opposite of acting moderately.
He agreed.
And what's done foolishly is done by folly, and what's done moderately by moderation.
He conceded this.
And if something is done by strength, it's done strongly, and if by weakness, weakly.
He agreed.
And if with speed, quickly, and if with slowness, slowly.
He agreed.
And if something is done in the same way, it's done by the same thing, and if in an opposite way, by its opposite.
He agreed.
Come now, I said, is there such a thing as beauty?
He granted it.
Is there anything opposite to this except ugliness?
There is not.
Well then, is there such a thing as good?
There is.
Is there anything opposite to it except bad?
There is not.
And is there such a thing as a high note in sound?
He agreed.
Is there anything opposite to it except the low note?
He said no.
So I said, for each single opposite there is only one opposite, not many.
He agreed.
Come then, I said, let's total up what we've agreed. We've agreed that one thing has only one opposite, and not more.
We have.
And that what is done oppositely is done by opposite things.
He agreed.
And we agreed that what is done foolishly is done oppositely to what is done moderately.
He agreed.
And that what is done moderately is done by moderation, and what is done foolishly by folly.
He granted this.
So if it's done oppositely, it would be done by an opposite thing.
Yes.
And one thing is done by moderation, the other by folly.
Yes.
Oppositely.
Quite so.
By opposite things, then.
Yes.
So folly is the opposite of moderation.
So it appears.
Do you remember, then, that earlier we agreed that folly is the opposite of wisdom?
He agreed.